Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. For millennia, human beings have watched the moon go through its cycle of phases, a rhythm to life on Earth and the gravitational forces that govern the ocean's tides. But only in the past 50 years have we been able to truly examine the moon from a scientific point of view, thanks to the Apollo program from 1968 to 1972 and the many unmanned spacecraft, including the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, that has helped map the moon in unprecedented detail. So what have we learned from the moon rocks the astronauts brought back to Earth and our remote sensing? Turns out the moon has a complex, fascinating, and still mysterious geological history, and here to talk about it with us is Professor Clive Neal. Neal is an expert on the moon's geology and its potential as the key to humans exploring space beyond Earth orbit. As a professor of civil, environmental engineering, and earth sciences at the University of Notre Dame, Clive Neal has become one of the leading voices for why it's a great idea not just to return to the moon with the planned NASA program called Artemis, the twin sister of Apollo in mythology, but how we can use the moon as an enabling resource to further our exploration of the solar system. Clive Neal, welcome to Blue Dot.
I'm very pleased to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
I understand you got interested in geology at a very young age. How did that happen?
I remember being interested in rocks before I even started school. And I would come home with piles of rocks in my hand from the fields. I lived out in the country in England. It was the bane of my mother. She didn't know what to do with all these rocks. And when I went to infant school, as it's called in England, you'd probably call that kindergarten here, I suppose. Yeah. So I remember asking Miss Byford, I told her I would like to be a paleontologist. What do I need to do to become a paleontologist? And she didn't know what a paleontologist was. But she went off and found some books, and then I was going to become a paleontologist. Until I went to university and had my first paleontology lecture. And then that killed that. And so I became an igneous petrologist volcanologist, which was much more interesting. So I knew what I wanted to be before I even started school, really. Apparently I'm unique in that, because none of my kids or my grandkids know what I'm talking about when I say, well, what do you mean you don't know? How old are you? 16? You should know by now. So it's,
No difficult. Sam Neill for you to Jurassic Park. You chose geology. Yeah.
No. Wrong sort of Neill. So.
All right. Well, how then did your love of geology get turned towards the moon?
Again, serendipity is the watchword in my life. I got a job I never applied for. And got this letter. I'd finished my PhD. I was at the University of East Anglia on the east coast of England doing a temporary lectureship, and that was running out. And on a Friday afternoon, I got this letter from the University of Tennessee in Knoxville from Professor Larry Taylor, offering me a postdoc, 2-year postdoc, where I'd spend most of my time studying mantle rocks from Earth, but then 20% would be devoted to Apollo lunar samples. And I thought, well, that's intriguing. So I went out and celebrated and woke up a little late the next day. And all I could think of was, I never applied to Tennessee. Why am I getting offered a job there? And it was because I came in second at Arizona, and this postdoc came up rapidly, and Larry needed a candidate, somebody to fill it quickly. He read my CV, and apparently it must have caught his eye, and he offered me the job. But yeah, pending an interview, which ended up being 11 p.m. my time in England, just after the pubs had closed. So I was very relaxed when I had the interview and got the job and moved to America. I thought, oh, 2 years in America, that'll be fun. Well, that was 1986, and I haven't left yet. So it's been... Yeah, what a ride, to paraphrase the astronauts.
Interview advice 101, you know, wait till the pubs close before you do the interview.
Yeah, maybe that's not the advice we want to give everybody.
Let's talk about lunar geology and the state of it, like before Apollo. Can you give us a sense of what were, you know, what were the prevailing theories about what the moon was made of and how it had come to be before the Apollo missions in from 1968 to 72?
Well, there were various theories about origin, such as, you know, the Earth was rotating much more rapidly in its past, and it actually fissioned out from the Earth. It's actually a blob of Earth that is out there when the Earth was rotating and still relatively molten during its early years. The other one was capture, that it was a passing asteroidal body that was captured into Earth's gravity. But neither of these options actually explain the angular momentum and the orbit and eccentricity of the moon in very well. And it wasn't until the return of the moon rocks, and it was Apollo 11 moon rocks that actually showed that the moon actually evolved by a magma ocean. And how do you get enough energy for a magma ocean? And that spawned the giant impact theory for an oblique impact of a Mars-sized body with Earth. The material that then came out was then ejected and went into orbit around the Earth, satisfies the angular momentum of the Earth-Moon system. And it also explains a lot of the similarities in composition between Earth and Moon, but does cause a few problems with that. But no model is perfect, and Harrison Schmitt is always points out the inconsistencies with the giant impact theory, and prefers the fission hypothesis. But
really,
that's how science gets done. You have these debates, and those questioning the paradigms allows you then to either prove or disprove them, make them stronger or make new ones. So it's, as I say to him, that it's good to have these opinions because it makes me think a lot more carefully about what I'm saying around you, number one, and that I have a very well-reasoned argument when we do have these discussions. So the idea that what was the lunar environment like was, you can see this in some of the Apollo lunar lander. They have huge pizza pan foot pads because it was considered that the regolith was going to be very fluffy because the gravity was lighter than Earth, and that there was potential for the lunar lander to actually sink into the regolith. So there is that issue as well. We just had zero information, even though we'd sent down the Ranger and the Surveyor robotic missions, that we were still thinking that the mass of the lunar lander could have an issue staying on the surface. And that was proven, that was disproved with Apollo 11.
Yeah. And what about this latest idea of the synestia, that there was this like a co-accreting cloud of material after the giant impact? What's your take on that?
Well, again, this is just a variation on the giant impact hypothesis. As we study it more and we get more information from the moon, that then causes us to question the giant impact and lunar magma ocean hypotheses, then models will develop to account for the new observations. So this is what I call an evolution of science. As we get more information, and then when we go back to the moon, and we're going to get a lot more information, I expect this evolution to continue. Now, it could go down a dead end and there was no more evolution of this particular idea and new ones have to be developed. But that's the scientific process. This is why I love this, because we're always exploring. When we're too old to learn new things, we need to sort of go away. And I hope I never get that old, because there's so much out there to learn. And this is why I'm coming to find that my career is too short to really learn all that you can. There's always something else to learn.
Well, let's give our listeners who are familiar with the moon a kind of a geology of the moon 101. When you look at the moon and you see the dark areas, the maria, and then you see the light areas that make up, the face of the man on the moon. Mm-hmm. Can you explain to us, basically what we're seeing in terms of the materials, the rocks? Why are why are the maria dark and why are the highlands light?
Okay, so we come back to the lunar magma ocean hypothesis. So we have the accretion of material around Earth to form the moon, a lot of energy. So initially, most of the moon or all of the moon was molten. And as the magma cooled down, it started to crystallize. And so crystals that come out of that magma, the highest melting point crystals, are very dense, and they sink to the bottom and they form the mantle, which is basically the source regions of erupted lavas. And the erupted lavas are what we see in the maria. But the other thing that happens as you go through this crystallization scheme, this mineral, plagioclase, is the name. It's a calcium aluminium silicate, or should I say aluminum, because I'm an American now. I can't remember.
It's fine either way.
Okay.
Depends on if we're in a pub. It's aluminium if we've had a few Guinnesses, but aluminum will do if you're drinking Coors Light or something like that, I suppose.
Well, I'll stick with aluminium. But this mineral was lighter than the magma, and so it floated. And this forms the primordial lunar crust. So as the theory goes, that as we look up, we see those white areas, we're actually looking at heavily impacted, very old, maybe even the primordial lunar crust that was formed after the magma ocean some 4.5 billion years ago. So to me, that just that very issue, when you look up and you look at the white areas, just think that I'm looking at something that's been around for almost 4.5 billion years that represents the initial differentiation or the crystallization of that early magma ocean. And then we've got these big impact basins that stripped off a lot of that low density material, and it allowed magmas generated in the interior, these basaltic magmas are very dark in color, to be erupted on the surface. So that's why we see this contrasting area. And originally, back in Copernican times, it was the times of Copernicus, it was considered to be, they were considered to be oceans, hence the Latin maria for seas. But they're actually seas of lava that has long since crystallized and cooled.
And that basaltic rock is, similar to what you would find like in the volcanic areas of Hawaii. It's that black volcanic rock. It's very dense and dark.
It is. Except there are two basic types.
Yeah, I was just going to ask, what are the differences?
There are some which are low titanium, which are similar to those erupted on Hawaii, and there are those that are unique to the moon. And this is the thing that always gets me when I get somebody come up and say, the moon landings were all faked in Hollywood and this sort of crap that comes out, because nobody ever talks about the samples. There are samples that are unique to the moon that we just don't find on the Earth. And these are the high titanium basalts. We have no terrestrial or earthly equivalent of those types of basalt. And you can't generate them in a lab that would then give you a 3.7 or 3.8 billion year age when you actually do the radiometric age dating on them. So you can't do that. So they cannot be manufactured in a lab. They can only be manufactured 3.8 billion years ago, and they are unique to the moon. So we must have gone there to get those samples and brought them back, rather than did everything in Hollywood and manufactured these in a lab. So there are similarities, but there are differences between what we find on this planet and what is actually on the moon. And those high titanium basalts are very important for actually in situ resource utilization, for actually using the materials to sustain humanity up on the moon.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Clive Neal. He's a professor at Notre Dame and one of the world's leading experts on the geology of the moon. We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back. Let's return to our conversation with lunar geology expert Clive Neal from the University of Notre Dame. One of the questions the Apollo missions were trying to answer was, are there areas on the moon that show, you know, fairly or at least relatively more recent volcanic activity? Did we ever really find any evidence of that?
Not during Apollo, no.
But since then, we've had orbiters, the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter and the Japanese Kaguya Orbiter. Have we found something, some interesting, tantalizing hints from them?
Yes, we certainly have. From LRO and Kaguya, and there's been a lot better imagery than during Apollo, which has led certain scientists to look at these crater count frequencies, or so the older the terrain or the surface, the more craters it will have. Because we have Apollo samples and we know the surfaces the Apollo missions landed on, we can use crater counts to age date that surface, and we get an absolute age from the samples that came back. So if we can then use that as a tie-in to that crater count curve, we can then use, you know, so those surfaces with fewer craters have younger ages. There's a chap by the name of Harry Heisinger, German lad that studied at Brown University under Jim Head and Carly Peters, and has published a number of papers on looking at the ages of the different surfaces in the Maria. And he has found surfaces at 1.2 billion years old and 2.5 billion years old. These lava flows in Oceanus Procellarum, and so they're on the lunar west side as you look at the moon. And so we do have indications that, well, Apollo samples do not represent everything that is on the lunar surface. And the more orbital missions we have, the more we see that.
I mean, that makes sense, because if you think about it, we only visited 6 sites on the moon.
There we go.
And, you know, that would be like if you went to Africa and you visited 6 different places and say, well, we know all about African geology now.
There you go.
Which leads me to my next question is, so as a geologist, and now we are preparing to return to the moon with the Artemis program, hopefully here in the next decade, where are the places that you are most interested in? Give us some of your candidates. If you could go anywhere, give us a few places, where would you be most interested to see samples returned from?
I would say anywhere that we haven't already visited on the moon will yield new and exciting scientific and exploration discoveries. So right now, Artemis 3 is destined for the South Pole. We have no experience of that environment there. It's going to be very different in terms of lighting, in terms of the plasma electrostatic environment, because of the way the surface is interacting with the rays of the sun. So I think that, and we've also got in that area these permanently shadowed regions whether they're micro or macro, they are a very different environment from what those that were visited during Apollo. So I think that there are discoveries to be made that we don't even know what those discoveries are going to be because of the difference between Apollo landing sites, the Soviet lunar or robotic sample return landing sites, and now this South Polar landing site. So it represents an opportunity for new scientific discoveries. And they've just completed, I believe, the Artemis Science Definition Team report for Artemis 3 in terms of the types of science that could be done there. And that includes sample return, but it also includes leaving monitoring instrumentation on that surface. So the science possibilities are really, really amazing. And I'm very enthusiastic for that. If we go back to the moon and stay and we get an intra-moon transportation system, I've just completing a paper on the areas of the moon that should be visited in order to facilitate return of samples that we just don't have any access to right now. We know that they're there, but we just don't know, because we know for that from orbit, but we don't have them in terrestrial labs where they can be the gift that keeps on giving. We've seen that with Apollo samples.
I was going to ask you about that because there are still samples that from, 1972 and that time that we're still, are still pristine, haven't really been studied. Could you just address, the foresight that it took to say, let's hold on to these until we have the technology to really unravel the secrets therein?
Well, again, and this is something that needs to be done for Artemis. That there needs to be something that's kept unopened for future generations and future techniques that are going to be developed, as we've seen with Apollo samples. For example, if we look at when the samples came back from Apollo, they're devoid of volatiles. There is no volatile cycle. There are no volatiles there. It's bone dry. Well, bone's pretty wet, but that's won't go there. But it was 2008 when samples collected in 1971 by Apollo 15 and 1972 by Apollo 17 were shown definitively to contain water, and that water was a product that was included in the source region in the lunar mantle. Now, this caused a stir because if you've got a giant impact followed by a lunar magma ocean, you expect the mantle of the moon to be devoid of volatiles.
Clive, can you explain to our listeners what volatiles mean?
Well, you're dealing with things such as water, such as hydrogen, such as fluorine, chlorine, sulfur. These are the things that sort of vent from terrestrial volcanoes. We see that when you go visit Hawaii Volcano Observatory on the Big Island, and you can see these vents, deposits of sulfur there, and you can see that. Now we had a hint of that from these basalts that returned by the Apollo missions that had bubbles in them. They had these things called vesicles, so it looks like a Swiss cheese sample because of the exsolution of gas. So the gas just came out of solution from the magma as the pressure was released, and then it got trapped as the magma crystallized. But this is the first time in some of these volcanic ashes, they've been called, or these pyroclastic glasses, where we saw the center of the glass containing higher abundances than the rim. So it shows that the volatiles were diffusing out of that particular little sample during eruption. So they must have been included in the magma at time of eruption. So they must have been in the source region when they were formed. So this revolutionized our thinking of the moon back in 2008, after from samples collected in 1971 and 72. So there are two samples that are actually cores of regolith that were collected and put in vacuum sealed vacuum chambers or core tubes on the surface of the moon. One of those was then put in another vacuum chamber when it was brought back to a vacuum tube when it was brought back to Earth. And then it was kept in a freezer pretty much since the early 70s. They've never been opened, but now they are about to be opened. And these could give us the first look, or tantalizing look, at the composition of the sun that these samples were exposed to, the solar wind. And this is, the moon has no atmosphere, so the sun is constantly bombarding it. And it's not just heat, it's particles. And it's particles such as carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen and hydrogen. So we don't know what that composition is, because all from the samples that have been brought back, because they were agitated. They weren't kept in vacuum after collection. They were agitated during sampling. They were then agitated during liftoff from the moon and back to Earth, landing back on Earth. And then they were agitated in transportation to the curatorial facility. So we get a minimum idea of what the solar wind component is. These samples could give us, if the seals have held over that time, the first look at the true composition of the solar wind component in the lunar soil or regolith.
Wow. And what technology do we have now that you could describe to us that enables that?
Well, we have very sensitive mass spectrometers. And we also have now precision tools that will allow us to pierce these stainless steel containers so that we can then immediately draw off any gases, headspace gases, that can be looked at it can be examined in great detail. So the mass spectrometers are more sensitive, much better accuracy and precision, because we're not expecting a whole lot, but it's going to be more than we see in the current collection, which weren't collected on the moon in that way, stored in a vacuum on the moon, brought back and then kept untouched at Johnson Space Center since the return in 72. So the other thing that it can do is because these have not been exposed to the dry nitrogen atmosphere of the curatorial facility, where we don't see any adsorbed materials on the surfaces of these of the regolith particles. These are very reactive, and you can see by the state of the astronauts' white spacesuits after their mission was over, there was a lot of dust adhering to the fabrics. So the electrostatic properties of, or understanding the surface properties of regolith, we can't really do with the existing sample collection because they've been kept in a dry nitrogen atmosphere. So that's got nitrogen stuck to it. So this would allow us to also understand the pristine surface of lunar regolith. And that's important for designing systems to actually work and be robust when we go back and have those types of machinery working on the moon to develop resources, to build habitats, and just transportation systems to get the astronauts to and from wherever they're going.
But before we talk about the returning to the moon, one last question about the geology is that one of the things I remember from Apollo 17 was the famous discovery of the orange soil by Gene Cernan and Jack Schmidt. And at first they, were all excited that these might be some kind of hydrothermal vent or something like that. Could you explain to us what they exactly found and what the implications are for what that is?
Well, what they found was a deposit that was the result of fire fountaining of magma into a vacuum. So you look at these very, very spherical glass beads. And the interesting thing is how spherical they are, how small they are. And that's because it is a gas-charged eruption. You see this on Hawaii, but it's not into a vacuum on Hawaii. It's into an atmosphere. So you get these irregular-shaped cinders that come out of these types of volcanoes on Earth. But because of the vacuum of space, it keeps expanding, and you end up with these little spheres that then fall back to Earth, and form these orange soil or orange glass deposits or green glass deposits from Apollo 15. So, but the orange color was very vivid, and once the surface was scuffed up, because it wasn't really at the surface, you could see just how vivid it was. So this was a revelation. So the idea of it being hydrothermal was thinking of a rust color on Earth, an oxidized iron. That's what you would get with hydrothermal activity, or a greeny color. But it wasn't that at all. It was the quenched glass, iron-rich, titanium-rich glass that gave you the orange color. So that was the immediate reaction, because you're doing analog geology. This is what we know from Earth. Oh, I recognize that. That's a hydrothermal vent. Well, no, it wasn't. It wasn't. Once you get down and dirty with the samples, you can see that it's very distinct.
Let's take a short break. When we return, we'll continue my interview with Clive Neal from Notre Dame as we talk about the geology of the moon and what its treasures may mean for the long-term exploration of space. Stay with us. We're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlom. Let's return to our conversation with University of Notre Dame professor and expert planetary geologist Clive Neal as we talk about the moon. Okay, well, let's talk about the future of exploring the moon and all of the unanswered questions. And maybe to lead into that, this recent discovery by the SOFIA science team, finding more evidence of water on the giant crater Clavius, which is also in the southern, part of the moon, not at the pole, but near there. But it is in sunlight, as I have heard, and I know that. And I also love the fact that, in 2001, the moon base was at Clavius. So I thought that was cool. In the movie 2001: A Space Odyssey. My question is, could put that into perspective for us. What have we found, and why is it important?
Well, the SOFIA result is important because we're starting to see, and have done since 2008, and then the Moon Mineralogy Mapper results that was on the Indian Chandrayaan-1 mission in 2009, that there appears to be a diurnal water cycle on the surface of the moon. This is where you see an expansion of hydroxyl or OH or H2O from the poles to the equator, as you go from lunar day to lunar night, and then it retreats back up to the equator during the lunar day. So that's what we saw from MQ. What we're seeing here, during a snapshot during the lunar day, was what appears to be an increasing water abundance on the surface away from the poles, i.e. in the opposite direction from MQ. Well, we don't understand that. Well, why is that? So they're talking about micrometeorite impact glasses containing the water from the meteorites, and we're seeing that signature. The issue I have with that is that we have these things in Apollo samples called agglutinates. And these are impact melt glasses that weld mineral fragments and other glass fragments together within the soil. And you can see a lot of these contain vesicles or bubbles, i.e. gases have been have formed and formed bubbles in these agglutinitic glasses, and then they're burst and they've been lost. And that's formed by micrometeoroid impact. So why would it be special at Clavius and nowhere else? So I think what we're seeing is that we've got a snapshot using the SOFIA instrumentation of one area on the moon at one time during the day. There were about an hour or two difference between the observations. So there needs to be follow-up observations to see at different times of the lunar day at that site and at different sites during different times of the lunar day. These questions that come up, these are tantalizing data, but it's pointing towards the fact that the moon has a volatile cycle or a water cycle that was unheard of during Apollo. That we're now getting these observations that you can have, 120, 130 Celsius temperatures during the lunar day and there's water on the surface. It makes no sense.
Well, yeah. And I remember in the late 1990s when Gene Shoemaker and I were visiting the late, mm-hmm. the late great geologist Gene Shoemaker. Yeah. And he told me about the very preliminary findings they got from the Clementine mission of finding water ice in the polar region of the moon. And then, course, the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter followed that up and found it. Could you explain to us the importance of finding these cold traps, what they are, and why they're important to the future exploration of the moon?
Oh, let's okay. So let's get into that. Well, let's sort of delta off the SOFIA observation and the M-cubed observation. So we M-cubed showed us this diurnal cycle. We know it's been hypothesized since 1961 that there would be water ice in permanently shadowed craters or cold traps on the moon at the poles. The Clementine radar observation gave us a hint that this was now a possibility. Lunar Prospector followed up with a neutron spectrometer and found rich hydrogen deposits at the lunar poles, but they had a very broad footprint for their observations. They hypothesized it would be in these permanently shadowed craters. Now we've got LRO, Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, that has got a neutron detector, which is as a smaller footprint, although still huge. But there are other instruments on there that give us an indication of surface ice in some of these permanently shadowed craters, as well as the neutrons that suggest it extends to depth. And we have our one point of ground truth, which was the LCROSS mission, the impactor into Cabeus crater, which was a mission co-manifest with LRO when it launched. And it was designed specifically to look at the composition of the volatiles in a plume of material that would come up into sunlight and then be recorded by a shepherding spacecraft that would analyze that material once the impactor had gone in and sent up this plume. So we have a one point of ground truth there to show that there's a lot of volatiles, not just water, in these permanently shadow craters, but organic materials, maybe prebiotic materials put there by comets. We don't know until we actually get samples and be able to analyze them in enough detail. But the water issue is something that everybody is jumping up and down about, because water on the moon, we've got life support consumables for astronauts, and then we've got the potential for rocket fuel for creating liquid oxygen, liquid hydrogen, the most efficient chemical propellants that we know. So this is important, but then we get into a bit of economic geology. So we've got overwhelming orbital evidence for the presence of water or water ice deposits and other volatiles in these permanently shadowed craters. What we don't have is an idea of how abundant they are, what is their vertical and lateral distribution, and can we actually extract it and refine it? Because we know it's dirty. We know it's not pure water ice. And this is all things that lead into understanding the resource versus reserve potential. So we get into semantics here now. We know that there's a resource there, potential resource. We know there's water there. Now, a reserve in economic geology terms is a subset of resources that we know is there, and we know the specific abundances, we know the specific compositions and purities, and we know that we can extract it at a potential profit. That's economic geology down on this planet. And I bring up the profit issue because this is critical for developing a cislunar economy and bringing in the private sector to be involved with these resources. We have an opportunity here for science and exploration to inform commerce by examining these potential volatile reserves in these coal traps. But there's a myriad of difficulties with that.
Yeah, and well, one of the things that occurs to me, I imagine to some listeners, is what are some of the implications ethically about, you know, extracting these resources, and is it like just first come, first take? What are some of the treaty implications of this? Is it just there for whoever gets there first, or how does that work?
Well, let's again, okay, so treaties. We have the Outer Space Treaty and the Moon Agreement. The U.S. has signed up for the Outer Space Treaty, the Peaceful Purposes of Space. The Moon Agreement is a bit more prescriptive in terms of the resources. The U.S. is not part of that Moon Agreement. I've talked to lawyers from countries that are part of the Moon Agreement, and they don't seem to think that there is an issue or any conflict between use of resources, extraction of resources, and the Moon Agreement. I'm not a lawyer, I'm just a geologist, but I'll let them deal with that. The issue is okay, why we're going to the moon and we're going to go with international partners. We've got this thing from the Space Council called the Artemis Accords, which I actually think is great. It is for the first time set a forum for discussion of this very issue that needs to be resolved in a peaceful and equitable way. I see that the international organizations such as COSPAR, for example, and COPUS is another one.
Which are what is COSPAR?
It's a committee that has been focused on many things in terms of space exploration for many years. Committee on Space Research, that's that one. And then the other one is a UN one called COPUS. And what has it done? And this is the thing, COPUS and COSPAR have been more the gatekeepers, and they're great at telling you what you can't do. And I think we need to get over that. I think we need to work together to enable the peaceful exploration of space.
Well, and as you have mentioned before, the moon is this enabling asset, and this pivot point for us to use to explore the solar system. And it's like the key to having a real spacefaring civilization. Tell us about your feelings about that.
Okay. My feelings about this, the enabling asset, I think it was Kraft Ehrlichi that said, if God intended us to be a spacefaring species, he'd have given us a moon.
And he did.
So we have a moon that is a wonderful place, scientifically interesting. We can learn a lot about the solar system by studying our moon, but that's another podcast. But the point about the moon being an enabling asset, if we are going to have human space exploration that is enduring, that is sustainable, we have to demonstrate to our decision makers and our governments that there is a tangible return on the taxpayer investment, that there's technology boost. I mean, Apollo, the technologies from Apollo are just immeasurable. I hold up my cell phone and say, thank you, Apollo, because you drove the miniaturization of electronics. And the NASA administrator gets it. There was this recent study on the impact of NASA's budget on the economy, and it was over a 3x return on the things that they outlined there. And we have to champion that, because space is important for the Earth. It's important for the benefits here on Earth, the tangible returns. The argument that why are we spending all this money on space exploration when we've got all these problems down Earth, that money's better spent down here. It's null and void, because the money that is generated by human space exploration, or can be generated by human space exploration, that starts with the moon, is going to outweigh any money we actually spend on that space exploration, and it will give back to humanity 3, 4, 10-fold what the current taxpayer is paying. And we need to look at the long-term investment. This is why the moon, and bringing in the cislunar economy, so that the space agencies, once the moon is what I, sorted, once we've got the moon up there, we've got a thriving lunar base. It is expanding. It is evolving. It is leveraging more and more from the commercial sector. Then the agencies go off to Mars, and we start setting up the cis-Martian economy. We've got transportation services between the Earth and Moon. We have transportation between Earth, Moon, Earth and Mars, and Moon and Mars. This is the future of humanity if we keep the current path, and if we use the Moon as that enabling asset. The Moon has resources. There are resources. We've talked about the water ice. That is the low-hanging fruit right now, because of LOX hydrogen, liquid oxygen, liquid hydrogen engines, and also life support. Water itself is also a great radiation shielder. Having a sheath of water around a habitat can help protect the astronauts when you're on the lunar surface or when you're on your way to Mars. So actually using lunar water from derived from a much lower or shallower gravity well than you have to transport it from Earth, you can put that on your Mars exploration vehicle as it's in orbit around the moon, getting refueled so it can go to Mars with a full tank and getting its radiation protection put on there. So this is the moon. The moon has helium-3. Everybody knows about helium, and you breathe it in and you talk funny. But helium-3 is an isotope of helium. Most of it on this planet is helium-4. But the solar wind has implanted a lot of helium-3 in the regolith. And that is the nirvana of nuclear fusion, where you fuse two nuclei together and the energy released far outweighs the energy put into that fusion. And you get no toxic byproducts. Everybody's familiar with nuclear fission, where you split the atom and you end up with radioactivity or radioactive daughter products that are thousands, if not millions of years, toxic to humanity. Well, helium-3, you don't get any toxic byproducts. And again, Harrison Schmitt's book, Return to the Moon, his study on helium-3 was that one shuttle cargo bay full of helium-3 would fill the United States for 1 year.
Wow.
Theoretically.
Yeah.
So we need to develop that technology. But we know there's a resource up there. China's very interested in that. Their Chang'e 1 and Chang'e 2 orbiters were trying to use their radiometers to define helium-3 maps on the lunar surface. Where are the richest deposits? Well, that wasn't just a scientific exercise. They're looking to the future energy needs. And this is a tangible return on the investment that the moon can offer. The other thing is just human spaceflight in general. We know that on station, when you go up there, your skeleton starts to dissolve. Now, if we can develop countermeasures for that skeletal degradation for human spaceflight, just think the benefits back on Earth for osteoporosis. These are the tangible returns. We've got to think strategically in the way we develop our technologies and the way that we develop our architectures to do spaceflight so that we and get to the moon to stay, so that we give that tangible return on investment and that we benefit society back on Earth. That is how the moon is an enabling asset, in my opinion.
Yeah, because in the past there's been this argument about going to the moon as a gateway to Mars, or just some kind of stepping stone, or you know, why go there at all? Why we've been there, we've done that. Let's just go to Mars. You know, we already did the moon. Who cares? Yeah. You know, so what you're saying is that's just the wrong way of looking at this.
The wrong way of looking at it. It's again okay. So we haven't sent humans beyond low Earth orbit since 1972. We don't know how to do that, yet we can go directly to Mars right now and not kill anybody. I don't buy it. I don't buy it because the radiation protection that you need is going to be prohibitive. Then what are you going to do with the deep space radiation environment and the microgravity on the human physiology? You get humans to Mars, they're going to be mush. You expect them to be productive? How are you going to maintain the human viability to and from Mars so that they are not only alive but productive? So we need a laboratory, if you like, that is outside the magnetosphere or the magnetic field of Earth, that is in the harsh radiation environment, where we can practice, where we can develop systems, where we can develop strategies. So another reason to go to the moon is to go to Mars and not kill humans in doing so.
Well, Clive, it's been a joy to talk to you. It's a fascinating topic. The moon has always been near and dear to my heart and its exploration. And I look forward to seeing the 14th person too, and I hope it's a woman who is the first person who sets foot on the moon, but whoever it is, it's going to be quite a dramatic moment.
Well, with 6 granddaughters, I keep telling them, well, you think about becoming an astronaut, maybe we'll see you on the moon. Let's go. So, and I think I would certainly support that. You noticed I've been saying humans rather than manned. They've taught me well. What can I say?
They're crude missions. They're not manned.
Sounds a little disgusting. It's too crude.
God, it's just too. It's too crude. Okay. Well, thank you, Clive. I so appreciate it.
Yeah, I loved it. I loved it.
Thanks again to our guest, Clive Neal from the University of Notre Dame. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX, and if you missed an episode or want to share one, check out our archives at mynspr.org. Subscribe to our podcast via the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. Our associate producer and owner of a dog named Rocket is Ellie Johnson. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.